From NPR West, you're listening to the podcast edition of All Things Considered, the best picks from our programs on Saturday and Sunday. I'm Arun Roth. In this episode, as Americans spend more of their income on rising rents, many families are running out of ways to pay for everything else.
You know, it's a little bit about trying to separate the miserable from the awful when you try to break it down.
A program in L.A. helps young men transition into fatherhood.
Everyone sees the mom. Everyone sees the mom pushing the stroller. So the dads, they're almost like an invisible group.
Karen Kilgariff writes music for Our Times.
If there's a moment of silence, look at your phone.
That's all on this episode of All Things Considered from NPR West. While mental illness wasn't a known factor in the events in Las Vegas, it has been at the foreground in a spate of recent shootings. Police officers around the country are dealing with this issue more and more. About 25 years ago, one young officer had an experience that forever changed the way he thought about mental illness.
A 27-year-old young woman, single mother of a 7-year-old child, tried to take my life.
That's Michael Woody. At the time, he was a sergeant for the Akron, Ohio Police Department.
She was charged with assault. I learned that she had had a mental illness for some time. I did not think that she would go to jail because she's ill. I figured she'd be found not guilty by reason of insanity. When she got the papers from the grand jury that she could do 7 to 25 years in prison, she ended up going to our high-level bridge that evening and took her own life.
Woody happened to be the closest officer to the bridge, so was the first to arrive on the scene.
And I could see the body below, but they left their purse. I didn't know who it was, and I opened the purse, and the identification told me that it was this young woman. And I guess what bothers me more than anything is boy, I hope her 7-year-old daughter, I hope somebody came along to take care of her. That's who my heart goes out to, and that's what's always bothered me, and that's where I realize that, boy, you know, we've got to change the way we deal with people that are sick, especially if it's a mental illness.
That became Woody's life work. He retired from the force and is now the president of CIT International, an organization that trains law enforcement to deal with mental illness in the field. CIT stands for Crisis Intervention Team.
Law enforcement seems to be our new go-to people, especially when a person with a mental illness is in crisis. It's usually in a home, parents calling because their child has refused to take their medication, they don't think they need their medication, they start to escalate, and it just keeps amping up to where the parents sometimes actually feel a little bit of danger for themselves and for their loved one.
These types of calls are pretty common.
10% of their calls will involve somebody with a mental illness. Those can be very dangerous, very tricky. You really have to know what you're doing to handle them, what I would say, properly.
But many of the officers facing these situations don't have a lot of training to fall back on. In Woody's home state of Ohio, education on handling mental illness gets lumped in with 16 hours of disabilities training, which covers everything from learning how to deal with blindness and epilepsy to schizophrenia. Woody says officers need much more specialized training to help them de-escalate situations involving the mentally ill.
You know, our uniform is made to gain respect and maybe sometimes intimidate you. So when we show up on the scene, just our uniform actually ratchets them up. So we get the officers to take a calm attitude, a low tone of voice. We don't ratchet up our voice as this person starts ratcheting up. We also teach them to listen. Even if it's nonsensical, this builds up that rapport and it just naturally calms the person down.
He's encouraged by what he's heard from officers who have had the training.
I get calls from all over the country from officers who say, you know what, Lieutenant Woody, that training, it saved my life. It saved me injury. It saved me from having to take the life of somebody that was mentally ill that I know I'd have had to live with the rest of my life. And it goes so much better that way.
Some departments already have a training program in place, but the extra training can stretch already thin budgets. Woody, though, is going to keep on pushing, hoping to prevent this generation of police from going through what he experienced as a young sergeant so many years ago. The code-breaking skills of mathematician Alan Turing helped the Allies win World War II. He also devised the Turing test, a measure of artificial intelligence. Last weekend, a computer program pretending to be a 13-year-old boy named Eugene Goostman was the first to pass the test, meaning the age of artificial intelligence has begun. Maybe. Gary Marcus is a professor of cognitive science at New York University. I asked him to explain how the test works.
It was devised in the teletype era, so those of you who don't remember what a teletype is can think of it as text messaging back and forth. So you text message to a computer or a person, you don't know which, and you try to decide. And that's basically what actually happened, is somebody managed to build a computer program that was good enough to fool a third of the judges.
Siri sort of does that, right? You ask your phone questions, and you can even throw in some abstract ones, and it'll come up with some creative responses on occasion.
Siri, like this program Eugene Goostman, interacts with you. You ask questions, and it gives answers. But most people aren't fooled into thinking that Siri is an actual person.
People who are into science fiction, I think especially, get really excited when we see this headline, "Computer Passes the Turing Test." But you think maybe not such a big deal.
Well, it's a small sign of progress, but it's not really progress towards the larger goal of having machines that really understand us. It turns out that you can do a lot of misdirection, answer sarcastically, and evade the fact that you are a computer. So all it really shows is you can fool humans for a short period of time, about 5 minutes, not all of the humans, but maybe more than you might have expected, by having these sort of personality twitches.
And well, let's give an example of that. You had an exchange with an earlier version of this program. Why don't we read that? I will read the part of Eugene Goostman.
I will play the role of myself as best I can. Do you read The New Yorker?
I read a lot of books. So many, I don't even remember which ones.
You remind me of Sarah Palin.
If I'm not mistaken, Sarah is a robot, just as many other quote-unquote people. We must destroy the plans of these talking trash cans.
Now see, your first impression, if you had that line in isolation, would be, hey, that's clever, it sounds like a 13-year-old boy, which is what the program's supposed to sound like. But if you talked to it for a long time, you would see that it uses the same laugh lines over and over again. If you asked it questions about common sense, you would find out very quickly that it doesn't really understand the world, that it's just a lot of pre-programmed responses and pattern recognition and so forth without any real there.
You know, I have to say from all of the exchanges that I've read with people who are talking with this machine, none of them seem very convincing. 30% of people need to be fooled for it to be considered to pass?
Based on a very, I think, foolish reading of Alan Turing's original essay, people decided that in order to, quote, pass this test, close quote, you'd have to fool 30% of the judges. And this program fooled 33% of the judges on this particular occasion. Turing was saying, I'm guessing that this is how far along we will be by the year 2000. He wasn't saying, and when we get there, that means that machines are necessarily intelligent. He was kind of opening the question, but people have taken his offhand suggestion as if it was the definition of intelligence. And I think that part's silly. And we might actually want to think about updating the Turing test for a modern era.
Yeah, because it seems, again, looking at these exchanges, maybe just 33% of people are more gullible, I hate to say it.
Yeah, it is kind of a gullibility test. What I suggested instead is have a machine watch a YouTube video or a TV broadcast and see if you can ask questions about it. So in order for a machine to understand an ongoing television program, an episode of Breaking Bad, the program would have to build up ideas over time. Well, this character does this. This is their motivation. This is the conflict. If we could get machines towards that, I think that would be real progress in AI. The Turing test itself, not so much.
So if this test doesn't really serve the purpose of determining whether we've broken through a barrier in artificial intelligence, is there anything valuable that can come out of it?
It gets people thinking about what will it be like when we do have intelligent machines that we really can interact with at that level, that follow us around, sort of like in that movie Her. I don't think that's going to happen in the next 20 years. It might take 40 or 50, but we will reach a society where we have more and more of these things around.
Gary Marcus is a professor of cognitive science at New York University. He's the author of Guitar Zero, and his forthcoming book is called The Future of the Brain. Gary, thank you.
Thanks a lot.
The mortgage crisis that devastated the economy has received endless attention, but it's not just homeowners who have suffered badly in this economy. As of 2012, 35% of American households are rentals. Their numbers are growing, reversing a decades-long uptick in home ownership. And in the last 50 years, the percentage of income they're spending on the rent has increased dramatically. A quarter of renters are spending more than half their income on rent. We wanted to spend some time with a family that has to apply that math to their lives. The rental crisis is our cover story today. A few days ago, Imelda Alvarez gave us a tour of her tiny one-bedroom apartment just east of downtown Los Angeles in a neighborhood called Boyle Heights.
Es el baño, según, muy chiquito, por cierto, y también la recamarita otra.
The tour takes all of 40 seconds. The front living room has been converted into a bedroom for Imelda and her husband. There's a tiny kitchen attached to the room with tables and chairs crammed in. And there's the recamarita. That's the little room in back with a bunk bed for her kids.
Y tengo dos hijas.
There's me, and I have two daughters, and my husband. So four in total.
Imelda and her family are paying $1,000 a month for this tiny place, but they don't have other options. Her husband Antonio can't land full-time work, let alone a job that could pay for a better apartment. He's been stringing together part-time work at a school nearby, bringing home biweekly checks of $500 or $600 at a time.
Most checks would be $600, so he would make around $1,200 a month, and that would only be enough for the rent and some bills.
Imelda says they spend so much on rent, they have to cut back in other areas.
Sometimes we have to start to think about what else we can cut back on to make ends meet. I always think about the rent first, then about food. If it's not enough, we have to cut back on food.
It's not like they're paying $1,000 a month for a tiny apartment in a trendy area. Boyle Heights is a poor part of town. There's a lot of crime, and most of the schools are struggling. It's hard to accuse the Alvarezes of living beyond their means when you see the state of their apartment. Sagging ceilings, leaky faucets, doors that don't lock, and pests, cockroaches and rats. The bathroom floor is wet because the toilet has come loose from the floor. Imelda had been staying home to watch their youngest daughter, who has an intellectual disability. But she's been looking for work now and can't find anything. And now that school is out for the summer, for the next couple of months, they'll be deprived even of Antonio's part-time income.
You know how we made ends meet this time? With our tax return. Everything was overdue, and it wasn't until our taxes came back that I could pay everything. I have nothing to pay with.
Across the city, families like the Alvarezes are struggling. But why is it so tough to find affordable housing in a city as big as Los Angeles? We asked reporter Ben Bergman of member station KPCC to find out.
The reason rent is so high here in L.A. is that lots of people want to live here. It's almost always sunny. You can go to the beach. But there aren't enough places to live.
I think in simple terms, it's an issue of supply and demand.
Beverly Kenworthy is head of the California Apartment Association.
If we really want to address this housing crisis, because it is a crisis, we have to really be much more forward-thinking, and we have to embrace development. We have to embrace the growth that's happening.
Kenworthy says developers have to navigate a city zoning code that is almost 70 years old. All but the biggest, best-funded builders have simply given up.
I have members of my organization who, some of them build, and some of them look to build here in L.A. I have others who just simply won't do it anymore because it's just too hard and too uncertain, and it's too costly.
We call it brain damage.
Carl Lambert says that's the phrase developers like him use to describe the agony of getting a project approved. Lambert says before he could break ground on a recent building, he needed 33 separate sign-offs. It's not uncommon for it to take 3 years from when he buys a piece of land to when he can start construction.
Now, I've experienced all this wonderful pain over the years, and I am now open. And do you think I'm going to want to just go out and give everybody deals? Or give them a $600 a month apartment with an ocean view? No, it's going to be fair market value.
And therein lies the problem. Apartments are being built in L.A. at levels not seen since before the recession, but most are top of the line. When it comes to affordable housing, there's a shortfall of almost 500,000 units in L.A. County. And it's only getting worse. That's because there is $500 million less available in state and federal funding for affordable housing in the county than there was before the recession. L.A. Councilman Gil Cedillo finds that troubling.
We focus on creating jobs here in Los Angeles for people who live outside of the city. And we don't focus on building housing for people so that they can live near where they work.
In April, Cedillo led a renter's day to highlight the problem of affordability. There was a modestly attended rally, but as for action, that will have to wait. In New York, Mayor Bill de Blasio recently announced an $8.2 billion plan to build and maintain 200,000 affordable housing units over the next decade. Cedillo says as much as he'd like to do something similar here, with the city trying to balance its budget, there's simply no money available.
You know, I really appreciate and admire those people do in New York because they really move aggressively on these problems. We don't have those types of resources to commit to housing.
Cedillo has been lobbying for a state bill that would raise $500 million a year for affordable housing by charging a fee on real estate transactions. But the measure's passage seems unlikely. That means for now, for the first time in three decades, there are virtually no state funds available for affordable housing in California. For NPR News, I'm Ben Bergman in Los Angeles.
As Ben just said, renters looking for affordable housing aren't getting much relief in Los Angeles, which is one of the most expensive rental markets in the country. But the problem is not just in California. Across the country, rental prices have risen as wages have stagnated. Chris Herbert is the director of research at Harvard's Joint Center for Housing Studies. Just last December, they released a report on rental housing in the country. He says the situation is bad everywhere. It's just a question of how bad.
You know, it's a little bit about trying to separate the miserable from the awful when you try to break it down. It is worse along the coasts. I mean, areas where San Francisco, L.A., New York, Boston, where you have very high housing costs. But at the same time, it's bad in the heartland, too. And it's bad in the heartland, not so much because housing costs are so high, but because incomes are so low.
Are there any places in the country where it's not a problem?
You know, I'm hard-pressed to come up with one where it isn't. Nationally, about 50% of renters are paying more than 30% of their income for monthly housing costs. And that's the standard measure of what people ought to devote out of their monthly budget and still have enough left over to meet life's necessities. When we look across the country at different metropolitan areas, there are very few that have less than, say, 35% of people who are struggling to make their ends meet that way. So I can't point to any place where it's not an issue.
Your study talks about those who are rent-burdened and those who are severe rent-burdened. Can you break down that distinction?
So the standard measure of housing affordability has been whether people are spending more than 30% of their income for housing, which is an old rule of thumb that it should be a week's wages for your monthly rent. But over time, what's happened is that so many people were failing to meet that standard that a new standard was introduced that was referred to as a severe rent burden, where people are spending more than 50% of their income for housing. There's not necessarily a rule of thumb that would suggest that that is an appropriate level of spending, but it's just one that had become so common that it became a new measure of saying, well, how severe is this extent of this problem? So if you look back over time in, say, 1970, roughly a quarter of households were spending more than 30% of their income on housing. Well, last count, more than a quarter of households were spending more than 50% of their income for housing. So we're really in a new level of affordability than we've ever been before.
Can you talk about why it's a problem in terms of when people are spending this much more on their rent?
Well, you know, it's such a big part of the household budget. If you're spending 50% of your income on housing, and we're talking about before-tax income, it doesn't leave a lot left over for life's necessities. We find that they spend 39% less on food. They spend 65% less on health care. They also spend less on retirement savings. And so the trade-offs that people are making are not trade-offs between going to the movies or going out to eat, but basically basic nutrition, basic health care, and saving for their future. So these are really important trade-offs people are making in trying to find affordable housing. And that's not to mention what they also do in terms of housing quality. So when we look at people who are facing a choice of trying to find housing that they can afford, one of the ways they make that trade-off is they settle for lower quality housing, and they're more likely to live in dangerous neighborhoods where crime is more prevalent.
That's Chris Herbert of Harvard. Chris, thank you.
My pleasure.
What Chris just said describes Imelda Alvarez and her family exactly. Back in Boyle Heights, they're out of options. Even if they could find a cheaper apartment, they wouldn't be able to move.
No tenemos para pagar el depósito.
We don't have enough for a deposit or rent, and we don't really want to leave because we have our roots here. The girls have their school here. It would be something hard for them, but it's mostly about money. It costs more to move.
It looks like more people will be experiencing what the Alvarezes have gone through. The Harvard study projects that around 4 to 5 million more people will start renting over the next decade. Again, thanks for listening. This is All Things Considered from NPR West. I'm Arun Roth. Comedian Karen Kilgariff has gone through a number of transformations over the years. She was a mainstay on the California stand-up scene before she became a cast member on the revolutionary sketch program Mr. Show with Bob and David. She was the longtime head writer for Ellen DeGeneres. Now she has emerged as a singer-songwriter, a pretty twisted one. Her new album is called Live at the Bootleg.
I want to win, I just wanna win. I wanna crush you till your windpipe caves in. And I wanna be the prettiest person at Earth Cafe. And I hate Tina Fey, I know that's taboo. So if you don't like it, you can f*** you. Cause I want her money, her glory, her baby, her dog and her job.
Karen Kilgariff came by our studios here in Culver City with her guitar and explained her latest transformation.
Originally, it was like the late 90s, and Marilyn Rice Cub and I started a group called Girls Guitar Club together.
She's an actress who was also on Mr. Show. She's on back on 24
right
now.
Back on 24, that's right. And she and I did comedy at Largo together and knew each other from the comedy scene, and we both liked playing guitar, but we were both equally bad at it. So we started the Girls Guitar Club, which was essentially we would do shows and talk about how we couldn't really play the guitar, but we wanted to do it anyway. And then we would just try to cover songs, and we started making up our own songs. And then we kind of got a little bit better as we, the more we did it, the better we got at it.
So let's get to the music. Let's hear a song.
Okay.
And you said you could start off with Look at Your Phone?
Yes,
one of my favorites?
Yeah.
Thank you.
If there's a moment of silence, look at your phone. And if you don't know what to say, you can look at your phone. There's no point looking around, everyone's looking down. Just look at your phone, look at your phone, look at your phone. What you gonna do when the grid goes down? Do you have a plan for yourself for when the grid goes down? Or will you be all alone, just staring at that cold dead phone in an apartment in West Covina? Check it. You could have some messages from someone far away, someone with something to say. If there's a moment of silence, look at your phone.
That's comedian Karen Kilgariff with Look at Your Phone. It appears on her new album, Live at the Bootleg. I wanted to take a picture of you with my phone while you were doing that, but I don't have it here.
Because then you know that it actually happened.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's the only way you can prove it.
It's not really real.
That's right.
That's a song I think connects with a lot of people.
Yes, I'm for sure. People laugh very knowingly when they hear it. Then they go back to looking at their phones.
So I got familiar with you first through Mr. Show with Bob and David. Mm-hmm. Please tell me you're proud of that work.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm as much as a fan as any fan that tells me they love the show. I mean, I'll never forget seeing their first taping, sitting in the audience and watching the live sketches and watching them roll in those sketches like the Founding Fathers. It's one of the first sketches they did, and just sitting there going, this is like mind-blowingly intelligent and hilarious and like edgy. You could tell something special is happening when you were watching it.
You've done a lot of behind-the-scenes work. You've been a writer, head writer with the Ellen DeGeneres Show, mm-hmm. more recently with Pete Holmes. Do these songs give you a chance to kind of be out there yourself and express
yeah.
something you wouldn't be able to ordinarily?
Yeah, I mean, I did regular stand-up for a long time, and I stopped doing stand-up when I worked on Ellen, which was for 5 years. So when I went back to it,
I found that, like, regular stand-up didn't really do it for me anymore. It almost felt insincere. Like, I wasn't saying anything I actually really wanted to say. Mm-hmm. But in writing songs, I can kind of say things that might be either too sincere for a comedy stage or too direct or something, and I feel like I can kind of get away with it.
Well, you open yourself up in these songs. I mean, they're funny songs, but, yeah. But you know, you reveal parts of yourself in you know, dangerous ways, which people usually do in comedy.
Yes, exactly. That, and I can't play that well, so it always feels like it's kind of there's a lot at risk. It's like walking a high wire a little bit, where it's just like this whole thing could fall apart. I did a show the other night, and right at the end of the song, when I was like, oh, we're like in the home stretch, the pick broke. It like snapped in half, like I was Yngwie Malmsteen. I was just like, how did that happen? And then I just had to kind of like plunk through the rest of it. So it's still very exciting.
What a rock and roll moment.
I know. I mean, I should have been wearing a scarf around my head. It was intense.
Well, because, you know, they're not novelty songs. Like they're I don't know quite how to describe these.
Yeah, they I kind of am not joking in them. I think yeah. That's the key. That's how you can be the funniest, I think, is you have to actually, you basically find something that you really mean that you're kind of scared to say, and then you pretend like you're being sarcastic about it.
So do you really hate Tina Fey?
Not in the least. No, not at all. I'm just a deeply jealous person, and I want to blame everybody else for what I don't have, and you know, that was like the best way to do it. That also, like, there's no better way to get people to pay attention to you, to what you're saying, than to say something like, that's like saying I hate Jesus, really, saying you hate Tina Fey. It's very edgy.
Let that settle in with me for a minute.
Yeah.
Tina Fey is
yeah,
like Jesus.
It is. Think about it. Think through all the things she's done for us. Very similar. She's walked his path.
Karen, great speaking with you.
So nice to meet you. Yeah, it was so fun.
And what do you got to take us out with?
I think I'll leave it on an up note.
Okay.
Oh, I wish I was as pretty as that porn star you're in love with, but I will never wear a tube top pumps or super skinny matchstick jeans, cause I was born with calves bigger than your average discus thrower's forearms. So for now, I'll just hang back and wait and see, and hope that one day you'll be scarred by acid or by love. If there's a God above, let him fix the score, cause right now you're a solid 9 and I'm a 4, but I couldn't love you more. If only life was like a sitcom, if only I could play the husband, then I could just be fat and funny, and you'd be hot and shut your mouth. But we all know our roles, it's impossible, it never will be otherwise. Men fall in love first through their eyes, and second through their eyes. So I hope one day you'll go blind from a macular disease, because there's no one else but me who loves you more. Now open up or I'll kick down your door, because in Atlanta.
Oh, it's so hard to keep quiet through that, especially the whistling. And I think By Acid or By Love is one of my favorite lines in any song ever.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah,
that means a lot.
That's special.
Yeah, there's two ways to go, acid or love. That's what I've discovered in this life.
That was awesome. Thank you.
Thank you.
Karen Kilgariff's new album is called Live at the Bootleg. Anthony Breznican reports on Hollywood for Entertainment Weekly. And like many people in Hollywood, he's got a story to tell. What's very un-Hollywood is that he's doing it in a novel. But he does have a Hollywood pitch.
It's kind of like Fight Club meets The Breakfast Club.
It's called Brutal Youth, a story of life at a Catholic high school where students cope with bullying by laying low, taking the punishment, or becoming bullies themselves. You might say you can find bullying in one form or another in just about every high school, but things are a little different at St. Michael the Archangel.
They've institutionalized it. It's sanctioned hazing, and this comes from my experience as a high school student, coming in as a little tiny freshman, 14 years old, and you're told, okay, well, there's this thing called initiation, and you're going to be, you know, picked on slash protected by some senior. And you don't know who you get. You get some sadist, and you're in really bad shape, you know. And this was the early 90s, and they saw it as sort of a harmless thing. It had been a tradition for as far back as anyone could remember. But at the time, it was terrifying. There's a lot of ways that people who are powerless assert dominance over each other. It's a way of saying, I'm not at the bottom of the totem pole. I'm able to climb up because I'm putting a foot on your neck. And the only rule in the school really is you can't pick on anybody who can actually hurt you back.
So let's talk about the characters in mm-hmm. this book. The three main characters, their kind of introduction to this school as their freshmen, it's one of the upperclassmen who's basically kind of lost his mind.
He snapped, yeah. The book begins with what I hoped would be kind of an exciting, perilous action sequence. You know, I remember in high school studying Shakespeare, and my English teacher said, notice how often he starts with an argument or a fight. That's how you get the attention of the audience. So I wanted to start with something kind of intense. And also thematically, I wanted to show, we're going to follow these three freshmen through their first year in high school. They're good kids. What happens to make a kid like that turn hard, turn sour, turn bitter? And I wanted to show the worst case scenario. And so we begin with a kid who's been pushed around and finally breaks. He snaps and he does something that he can't take back. And in that act of violence, he climbs up to the roof to get away from something he's done, and he ends up pushing over these saints, these stone statues, trying to hit the people below. And I thought, that's pretty terrifying. So we can have our main characters kind of run out and try to be the heroes, and you see them trying to do the right thing. And as the story goes on, you see how a kid goes from someone who'll run out in the middle of danger to save somebody he doesn't even know to possibly becoming the one who's trying to cause the pain.
Well, there is. I mean, the book is very dark. Yeah. But at the same time, there's this bullying. You know, these two male characters, Peter Davidek and Noah Stein, they have a really powerful friendship.
Yeah, yeah. You know, the people who are with you when you're kind of in that embryonic stage of being a teenager, figuring out who you are, I think those are the people who make a difference for you. And you never forget them. Those are like foxhole friendships, mm-hmm. you know. And the friend who takes the punch, who takes the blame, who absorbs the insult when they know you can't take any more, those are priceless friendships. And I wanted to sort of pay tribute to that in this story. And to do that, I had to put the kids through some really bad stuff.
and in terms of the bad stuff, Peter and Noah have different ideas about how you survive high school. Could you talk about their approaches?
You know, Peter Davidek, he's, you know, a lot like me. I think when I was that age, I just wanted to lay low, wanted to do my thing and not make any waves. And Noah Stein is that side of me that's like, you know, you got to pick your battles. Let's pick everyone. Let's pick every fight. He really means well, but there's no fight he won't take as long as it's for the right cause. He doesn't pick on anybody.
You have a character named Hannah, who she's one of the older students there, and she's been so tormented. She's changed her hair color multiple times to try to
change her appearance. You know, she's a kind of mysterious character for about half of the book. Hannah was one of the most picked upon students at this school over 4 years. And to protect herself, she has been kind of like Madame Defarge in A Tale of Two Cities. She sits quietly and gathers everyone's secrets. She overhears a lot of things. And so at the end of the year, there's this big picnic, and they have a little talent show. That was considered the end of your initiation, this kind of talent show. And her plan is to take her freshman and force him to read in front of the audience her little collection of secrets. She's going to kind of throw a match over her shoulder as she leaves the school. And she's going to use one of the freshmen to sort of strike that match or to be the match. And any kid who does that is doomed for the next 3 years. You're not going to make it out of your freshman hazing. You're going to be the kid who embarrassed everyone.
You know, it's almost impossible to read this and be thinking about high school and bullying and not think about, you know, today, social media, because – the things that have this power in this book, yeah. like the secrets that that say Hannah has. I don't know if it's better or worse now that there is social media involved.
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, the diary, the handwritten diary, was my effort to kind of, this story is set in 1991, and I wanted that to be a little bit representative of what we face today with kids being bullied and called names on Facebook, Twitter, Tumblr, you know, any kind of social media could be used as a blunt instrument in the wrong hands. And I think this is the analog version of that. The reason that's such a powerfully intimidating format is whatever name you're being called, whatever rumor is being spread about you, it's now published. It's now permanent. And I think the same kind of bullying and manipulation happens now with kids that happened back when you and I were teenagers. The difference is that adults now have a record of it. They can look and see, oh, my God, this is what they're calling you? It's no longer some whispered thing in the hallway. It has a permanence. There's a trail. And I don't know if that makes it better or worse. It makes it a little harder to escape because a friend of mine who's active with the anti-bullying group GLSEN said, now you can't go to your room and close the door and be safe. You fire up your computer and there's somebody on Facebook mocking you. Kids, they're especially vulnerable, and that's why we see, you know, these tragic cases of kids who commit suicide. It's like, why? It's high school. You're almost out. Why would you give up like that? But we forget when we get older how painful that can be. You're like this newly hatched chick. You don't have any guard up. You don't have any armor. And I think what I tried to explore with the book is how that armor forms and how, if you're not careful, it can go so deep that it hardens you right to your core.
That's Anthony Bresnahan. His new novel, his first novel, is called Brutal Youth. Anthony, thank you.
Thank you very much.
To all you dads out there, happy Father's Day. Last Wednesday night, I went to a class that teaches men how to be better fathers.
What did we talk about last week? Remember?
The volcano.
Volcano. Volcano of what?
Feelings.
Feelings?
This class, though, was not aimed at me. Not that I couldn't use some help with my volcano of feelings. But this class is for young dads, as young as it gets. In the 2 years this program has been running in Los Angeles, the youngest father to pass through was 14. The LA Fathers Program, which meets weekly, is run through the adolescent medicine branch of LA's Children's Hospital. When it comes to kids having kids, it's usually the mothers who get the most attention and support. But today, we wanted to show you what some young men are going through as they work to become good fathers.
You know, they're not telling you what they need. In that way, you have to sort of be the detective to figure it out. But even when they're older, like your sister...
Ben Wright is running the parenting discussion tonight.
She's just having a big eruption, right?
When my daughter, when she was like an infant, she pretty much would cry, you know, even if she had her diaper changed, you know.
There are about a dozen fathers here for class tonight. They range in age from 17 to 27. Sitting around a large table, this week, like every week, they have a check-in.
I'm Roy. I have a 4-year-old daughter.
My name is Marquis. I'm 22. I got a son.
My name is Casey. I'm a father figure for my niece, Alicia.
Nice to meet everybody. My name is Brian.
Got 3 kids. My son's 2. My daughter's 1. And my newborn is 4 months.
Over 400 young fathers have passed through this program.
Yeah, I'm talking about my new girl right now. She's straight tripping, bro.
She's straight tripping.
Hey, I'm serious.
It's a pretty lively and fun crew tonight. The discussion ranges from resume building to romance.
Okay, so you observe that she's tripping.
All right.
What do you think she's feeling?
That's the voice of Frank Blaney. He's head of the project, and he runs part of the meeting. In addition to material things like free diapers and transportation tokens, these young men are here to get help finding jobs, learning to be better parents, and working on relationships with the mothers of their children. Blaney says that for most of the young dads here, the thing they need more than anything else is peer support.
As they find out that they're dads, they're usually unexpected, they're not planning to be dads, they just get a lot of criticism and a lot of judgment from everybody in their family. It sometimes comes from their parents, oftentimes comes from the partner's parents, the mother of the baby. A lot of times their friends look down on them, so they basically just go from having a broader social support circle to none.
The young fathers here are mostly Black and Latino. Money is tight for them, and some of the fathers have been homeless. And many didn't have any kind of father figure of their own, like Anthony Gomez. He has a 2-year-old daughter.
You know, I never had a father, like,
no one, like, you know, in that
like
key.
Like father figure?
Yeah, you know, so I don't really know much about what a man should know.
And as Frank Blaney told me, that's one of the things they work on here.
They're trying to figure out what to do with this new life that's in their life, and they're trying to just cope and navigate with that. If they can get some information from the staff, if they can get some support from young men that are in the same position, it really means a lot to them.
These weekly meetings are a safe place for these young dads to open up.
When I see myself crying, I get mad at myself. And I'm like, why are you crying?
Look in the mirror then.
17-year-old Joal Ramirez has been coming here for about 3 months. Joal has a 6-month-old son. He says he found out about the group from his older brother, who's also in the program. When he first started coming, Joal says he was reluctant to open up. Now, he shares a lot.
When she told me she was pregnant, I started crying. I was at school, too. I
get that one, too. I'd be like, my life is over now.
I wasn't saying that. I was at football practice, and she called me. I started crying, you know.
Joal tells me he's still in high school now, but like many of these guys, he's been pressured to drop out, to get a job. His son's mother is 19, and she's already graduated.
A lot of people are like, oh, what are you going to do? Are you going to drop out of school? And I always told myself, never, you know, I'm not going to drop out of school because my brother, a lot of my brothers just didn't finish high school, and they're working minimum wage, and I don't want to be like that. I want to give my son all I can, and I want to give myself all I can. To me, a high school diploma is more than a GED. School really helps.
The L.A. Fathers program is helping him line up some summer jobs. When he's over 18, they'll help him with his resume and other job skills. But for Joal, the most helpful part has been learning about anger management.
You know, everybody gets angry fast, but, like, some people get angry fast, and I don't want my son to be like that, you know, because it helps to talk.
He tells me the program has changed his idea of what it means to be a dad.
My real dad was in prison all my life, and the guy who was raising me was my uncle, and he's in prison now doing life. I don't want to be like that.
Joal plans to finish high school, join the Marines, and go to college. Frank Blaney says the stereotype of the unmarried young father as irresponsible deadbeat is just flat wrong.
To be honest with you, I just haven't seen that. A lot of these guys, especially ones that haven't grown up without a father, know how painful that experience is. And instead of being bitter about that, they really make a 180 and make a 110% commitment of being there for their kids. Everyone sees the mom. Everyone sees the mom pushing the stroller. So the dads, they're almost like an invisible group. No one can really tell. And that's why we're really trying our best to let the community organizations that we work with, the social institutions that are here, let them know that these resources exist.
These dads attend classes for at least 8 weeks. At 27, Roy Monsanto is one of the older young dads, and now he's coming as a volunteer.
I mean, like, I feel like people in general, it's kind of hard for people to accept that someone truly cares and loves them. Because it's like, why does this person love me? You know, why are they telling me that they love me? You know?
So let me throw this at you. Is that person actually in love with you, or are they in love with the fact that you love them?
That's a good one.
I like that. Hey, why'd you write that down as a quote? I like that right there.
Once they have that child, they really take to heart that responsibility, and it seems to create like an opening in their mind and their heart to want to grow, to really get past all the nonsense that they maybe were involved in as teenagers and young people and really push through and be there for their family. For me, it's very encouraging to see that on a daily basis.
All the young dads I spoke with were excited about Father's Day. For Joal Ramirez, it's his first. Sadly, though, he's been having a dispute with his son's mother over visitation rights. So for today, he has a simple wish.
Just take my son to the park, have a little picnic with him. You know, he can't eat that much, but feed him Gerber. Yeah, as long as I see my son, that's the best Father's Day I can ever have.
Frank Blaney's target is to get 250 young men through the program each year. So far, they're on track. Again, thanks for listening. This is All Things Considered from NPR West. I'm Arun Roth.
Crazy, I'm crazy for feeling.
Hello, walls.
Hello. Pretty paper, pretty ribbon. Oh, the nightlife ain't no good life.
Gee, ain't
shining funny, how time slips away.
All those hit records you just heard were written by the same redheaded stranger from Texas, long before he'd have his own hits.
On the road again, just can't wait to get on the road again.
Willie Nelson proved his songwriting chops years ago, but over the past two decades, he's preferred to record other people's writing, not his own. His new album comes out on Tuesday. It's called Band of Brothers, and for the first time in almost 20 years, he's given us a record packed with Willie Nelson originals.
We're a band of brothers and sisters and whatever, on a mission to break all the rules. And I know you love me 'cause I love you too, but you can't tell me what to do.
I spoke with Willie Nelson on Friday night, not surprisingly, on the road again. At the age of 81, he's currently on a grueling tour, more than two dozen shows this summer. He joined us where he seems the most comfortable, on his beloved tour bus.
We're somewhere around Philadelphia, I think, getting ready to do a show tonight.
And here's how much of a road dog you are. I've read, tell me if this is true, that you even sleep on the bus when it's parked at your house?
Well, yeah, I have everything I need here, and it's a lot of hassle to get off and go into a room and come back. So I have a room available if I need it or want it for anything.
Now, you are such a great songwriter, but it's been more than a few years since you released an album with so much new material on it. I'm curious, have you been writing songs the whole time, or are all these very recently written?
I'm a sort of a spasmodic writer, I guess. Roger Miller said it pretty well. He said when a writer has to sometimes stop and let the well refill because you run out of things to write about or good things to say. And I think he's right. And also, you have to have some kind of challenge or goal. And there was this new album that we wanted to do, and I needed some new songs. And I said, well, you know, why don't I write something?
There's a guitar in the corner that used to have a song. I would hold it while it played me, and I would sing along.
You know, when I think of my favorite Willie Nelson songs, they have this quality of you can be sentimental, but without being cheesy or cloying. And I feel like on the new album, The Wall is one that kind of fits into that category.
I took on more than I could handle. I bit off more than I could chew. I hit the wall.
What inspired that?
Well, actually, it's a true story. I literally got so tired, overbooked myself, and wound up having some work done, some health work, and I went over to Germany to get that done. And while I was over there, I wrote this song, The Wall.
And the wall came down, crashing down, and there was not a sound.
You've got on this album, there's a great kind of combination. A couple of really funny songs, Wives and Girlfriends.
Well, I love my wives and I love my girlfriends, but may they never meet. May they never know each other when they pass on the street.
And right after that, you have a song that might be the wives and girlfriends' response, I Thought I Left You.
What part of we can't make it, don't you understand? It's no longer you and me. There's another world you see. I thought I left you, so why aren't you leaving me?
You know, the two sides like that makes me think of phases and stages. You know, the album where you tell the story of both sides of a breakup. There's side A is the woman's perspective, side B is the man's. I'm wondering what you get out of changing perspectives as a songwriter. How do you write as a woman?
Well, I have had a little experience, and I've been around a lot of women, so you'd think I'd have learned more than I know, but I have learned enough to write a few stories and songs that, you know, I think are pretty truthful and not too bad.
After carefully considering
the whole situation, and I stand with my back to the wall.
Now, when you're doing that, when you're changing perspectives, do you feel like you sort of become the person in the voice of the song you're writing, or are you kind of like at a distance, you know, the creator?
Well, I think it depends on the situation, and that particular story, Phases and Stages, it wasn't really that difficult to write both sides of the story, because at that time I was going through both sides, and it was just a matter of writing what I thought might be going through a woman's mind and what was going through mine, and trying to tell both sides of the story, because, you know, there always is.
Most of us, though, are so wrapped up, trapped in our own skins, though. I think it's hard for most people to kind of step outside in that way.
Well, I'm such a shameless songwriter that I'll write about anything.
Walking is better than running away, and crawling ain't no good at all.
A few months ago, you made news when you earned your fifth degree black belt in the Korean martial art, Gangkwang Yusul. Am I saying that right?
That was right, yeah. That's better than I can say.
Well, what I know about it, I know it's one of the most demanding and comprehensive styles of martial arts. You must be in incredible shape.
I'm really healthy, and, you know, who knows why? I think a lot of it has to do with my doing shows a lot. I think when you get out there and sing for an hour and a half and play the guitar and move around and wave and clap, that's probably the best exercise or best workout that you can do. And, you know, I do 150 so shows a year, and that's just really good exercise for me.
And when you're at that level of fifth degree black belt, I'm curious if the disciplines, the philosophy of the martial arts have had an effect on your performance, on your songwriting.
Oh, I don't think you can separate it at all. It's good for you spiritually, physically, mentally. There's a little air of confidence that you get, and I think it shows up in your performances, also in your songwriting. It's been good for me, that's all I can say.
Your new album ends with a song called I've Got a Lot of Traveling to Do. Can I take that to mean that you've got no plans to slow down anytime soon?
You know, I was telling somebody the other day that I quit after every tour, but after a few days off, I say, well, let's try it again. So, I'm having fun. The audience is still there and seem to be enjoying the show, so I don't have any plans to quit right now.
I got a lot of travel, man, to do. A whole lot of travel, man, to do. Well, the road is getting crowded, and they're shortening my fuse, and there ain't nothing here I really care to lose. I got a lot of traveling to do.
Willie Nelson, thank you so much.
All right, well, thank you very much. Enjoy talking to you.
Willie Nelson's new album comes out on Tuesday. It's called Band of Brothers.
Of course I can't forgive you, cause that's just what I do. Got a lot of traveling.
For the week ending June 15th, 2014, that's the podcast edition of All Things Considered from NPR West, the best of our programs from Saturday and Sunday. The production staff includes Becky Hersher, Tom Dreisbach, Priska Neely, Becky Sullivan, Stephen Jackson, and Daniel Hajek. Our intern is Jen Velez. Am I saying your name right? Yeah? Okay. Marcia Caldwell is standing in for Patrick Murray as technical director. We had technical support from Leo Delagula. Muthoni Muturi is our senior editor, and Phil Harrell is in for Steve Lichtai as senior producer. I'm Arun Roth. Remember, you can always hear the show on your local public radio station. Thanks for listening.
Hello, goodbye to you. Like one more and write a song.